308 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. Where stands a mighty grove of oak trees? This valley signifies the mundane sphere or lower world into which the generating soul is conducted. The east is the portal of generation, for it denotes the place of the nativity in a horoscope. So the west wind blows the soul gently into birth. The grove of trees signifies creation, which is, as it were, a clump of mighty agencies. In the midst of this grove is the palace of the world, where there are vast treasures and the jewels of the stars. The tracings upon the walls of the palace are the constellations, those vast signs upon the walls of heaven which hem in our solar system and are the limits of the mundane house. Here Psyche is served by invisible beings whose voices she hears, for having descended from her true estate, the spiritual agencies which are her excellence are no longer visible. But their voices still speak to her inner nature, even as the gods still speak through the oracle of the human heart. Psyche, however, is not yet physical and mortal, hence the physical agencies of creation are also invisible. Suspended thus between two spheres, she wanders in the great house of life which she is eventually to discover is the dwelling place of Cupid. Cupid is chiefly familiar to the 20th century as the match maker supreme, but in antiquity he played a most significant role. He is the symbol of love which, according to philosophy, has a duality of natures. The first is that supernal passion by which the soul is moved while still pure and undefiled in the luminance of the soul sphere. The second is mortal love, in which the soul, deluded by the findings of sense, exchanges for the adoration of internal qualities the infatuation for external appearance. Married to an invisible being, Psyche thus becomes the bride of spiritual love, into which union the element of form or materiality has not yet entered. She dwells in a beautiful astral palace, served by creatures whose natures have not yet been invested with mortal fabric. Here she remains until her sisters, who signify mortal instincts, begin to pull her down ward into the sphere of sense. When Psyche beholds the physical form of her husband, spiritual love is changed into material passion. She is forthwith precipitated from her heavenly palace into the broad meadow of the earth, where broken-hearted she wanders in search of the happiness she foolishly sacrificed by listening to the voices of worldliness. She then becomes a servant of Venus, who sets for the unfortunate girl a number of difficult as well as dangerous tasks. These tasks represent the labors of life, the misfortunes of existence which generation heaps upon those who come beneath its sway. In each instance, however, she is assisted by a heavenly voice which, representative of the ever-present daemon or divinity, with its greater vision leads the soul befogged by matter through the tortuous byways of existence. When Venus enslaves Psyche, the lower love becomes master of the soul qualities, and the shackles of desire hold the will in bondage to the animal propensities. The last task set by Venus for Psyche to perform is the journey to Hades to bring back with her from the sphere of the dead a casket filled with beauty. This casket signified physical life, which the ignorant soul believes to be the receptacle of happiness and beauty, but which proves, upon opening, to contain only an evil and stupefying spirit. Seizing the soul, this spirit causes it to descend into the very depths of corporeality, there to remain until Cupid, or love, comes to awaken and elevate it to its lost estate. Cupid, the invisible god, is rational love, that affection which is seated in the true qualities of the soul. This higher and more divine emotion, rousing the rational soul as from a stupor, communicates its vitality thereto and thus enables the soul by rational procedure to cast off the lethargy of the ilug, zions of the flesh. Upon completion of this task, psyche placates the angry Venus and even wins favor in the sight of awful Zeus, the demiurgus himself. Thereupon she is given the heavenly drink and ceasing to be immortal verges toward the immortals. She thus becomes the mother of joy, which is born of the union of the rationality in each soul with that greater. Emerson's concept of the oversoul. 309. 310 Lectures on Enseant Philosophy. Rationality, which is the invisible but all-potent God of intellect. 12 Love. Thus is set forth the story of a prodigal daughter whose experiences parallel those contained in the biblical allegory of the prodigal son. Here also is the key to the allegory of Lohengrin, for the young prince of the Holy Grail is divine and unnamed love, which is destroyed or forced to retire when its nature is brought within the sphere of denomination. From the foregoing it is evident that the integrity of man is posited in his superior part, and regardless of the physical inhibitions by which the flow of his divinity is impeded, that which is essentially good and true must perforce ultimately dominate the entire character. Not without just cause does man instinctively turn to his own soul for consolation and guidance. While he may not consciously realize the immensity of reality, he senses an expansive principle which, residing within the innermost recesses of his being, is ever ready to incline him toward perfection. Life posits its own awareness in the soul quality. Through the soul, spirit learns of its own apparent aloofness from, yet its actual identity with, matter, clothing its own transcendency. In soul, spirit gives its impersonal self into the keeping of a personal nature, clothed with the rationality of a personal nature. Spirit descends into the inferior universe to fulfill the natural law of being, that in the nature of perfect existence, there shall constantly manifest generations. The divine plan includes an order of forms through which life principles continually flow from awareness through the veil of unawareness, back to awareness again. In philosophy, therefore, we labor without ceasing to stimulate our higher natures and thereby rouse the soul from the lethargy of materiality, permit it to ascend from personals to impersonals, from forms to the estates of the formless, to be finally reunited with that sovereign voice of rational, or intellect. 12. Love, that passion of the soul for reality, that impulse to verge toward those natures partaking most fully of the permanently beautiful. Thus, within human nature, which is incapable of appreciation in its fullest sense, dwells an all comprehending power, the human soul, which ever seeks reunion with that omniscience to which each action of universal agency is, in turn, the object of a profound appreciation. This greater soul, this mysterious Cupid, this formless being, which man may not behold without destroying, this least of forms and most of spirit, this is the true oversoul in whose intellection we are perpetually immersed and of whose transcendency we continually partake. Emerson's concept of the oversoul. 311. The planes of the generating sphere. Assuming the illusion of form, the spiritual life descends out of its own radiant nature and takes upon itself in sequential order a mental constitution, an emotional or astral constitution, a vital constitution, and, lastly, a physical constitution. These four constitutions are united to the non-incarnating spiritual self by a thread of life. Chapter 14. Ecoteric and De-Esoteric K-Knowledge. In Plato's Charmids, wisdom is declared to be the science of itself and also the science of other sciences, furthermore, the science of the absence of science and the science of mental temperances. While all other divisions of learning are con concerned with objects, substances, places, or conditions, wisdom is concerned with its own nature. From it flow, however, all other sciences, and by it is determined not only the knowable, but the unknowable, not only the extent of that which is but, also the extent of that which is not. Defined as the proper temperance of the mind, this wisdom, verging toward neither extreme but abiding in perpetual equilibrium, may be likened to the monad of knowing, the unity of rationality, the summit of all sciences and speculations. Today we have preserved those sciences which are properly termed the classifiers of extraneous facts, but that form of wisdom which is primarily concerned with the substance of erudition itself has vanished from the institutes of man. As Plato further observes, a wise and temperate man is one capable of correctly estimating the extent not only of his own knowledge or ignorance but also of performing the same service for others. No one is wise who is not as fully acquainted with the extent of ignorance as with the extent of wisdom, for in mortal concerns wisdom is an inconsequential area of rationality existing in an infinite expanse of ignorance. Temperamentally a skeptic, Socrates infers that wisdom is not the knowledge of things but the knowledge of the condition of knowledge with respect to its absence or presence, in 313. 314 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. Observation plainly intimating that wisdom deals with generals and not with particulars. Wisdom may therefore be considered as composed of the universals of knowing and the sciences of the particulars of knowing, which as the practical are sus pended from theory. Exoteric knowledge then can be defined as the knowledge of particulars, a familiarity with those arts and sciences arrived at through application and concentration upon external natures. Conversely, esoteric knowledge is concerned with the inherent nature of knowledge itself and is limited to those acquainted with the more profound issues of philosophy and rational theology. Lest the reader grasp too much of this sublime teaching, Plato causes Socrates to refute the statements concerning this abstract science of knowing, thus making it perceptible only to such as are in turn able to refute Socrates. When he claimed for science that it would wrest from theology the entire domain of cosmological theory, Professor Tyndall would so magnify the part as to swallow up the whole. The puerility of such an assumption is self-apparent, for science, by virtue of its very nature, has not and cannot invade the realm of true theology. Science may overthrow the false gods and dogmas of creed, but the mysteries of the divine spheres elude the grasp of corporeal learning since they belong to a more subtle and esoteric realm. Never until knowledge is capable of analyzing itself can it retire into its own causal nature and behold the luminous and stupendous wholeness from which beings are suspended by most intangible threads. Thus while the knowledge of external natures and the classification of objective phenomena are the definite province of science, none but the mysteries held the true keys to wisdom. They were the custodians of secrets most arcane. Through peculiar disciplines they equipped certain selected mortals with rational instruments by which to measure, estimate, and classify those internal facts which forever elude the intellect delimited by its training to the phenomena of the exterior universe. Founded, according to Sanconiathon, in the night of time, the mysteries were established upon the premise of this too.